everyone. Welcome to minute 9 of season 10 of Movie Our Minute, the daily podcast, where we hijack our way through the 1974 classic movie, The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again is Stephen J. Rubin, a podcaster, a producer, a screenwriter, a film historian, and an author. Welcome back to the show, Steve.
Hey, Rob, I'm enjoying this very much. I almost feel like I am a passenger on this subway car. I am sitting near the exit because if there's an opportunity to get off this train, I'm getting off.
Well, the doors are still open. You can get off now. You better do it right before they close. Once they close, they're about to close, and that'll be it.
The window is closing. I'm on it for the duration.
Apparently. So, minute 9 begins with Blue telling the conductor the way it is, and ends with the driver's cab being filled to capacity. So we ended things yesterday with the driver of this train getting surprised, he had to rear Matthew Broderick, but he was still surprised by the fact that Mr. Blue has blocked his view and then pulled a gun on him. Not really sure what he expects day to day. Probably not this. I didn't do the research on it, but I'm wondering if hijacking trains was ever really a fad in the 70s. I mean, obviously, when you think of hijacking trains, it's stuff that happened in the old West when you
yes, it's Jesse James and the James Gang. I think the idea. I don't think there's, to my knowledge, I've never heard of a train being hijacked. And of course, the idea of a subway car being hijacked is so ridiculous because there's no way they can get away, which makes the movie interesting because you really don't know how they're going to get away with this. And that is one of the compelling aspects of this movie. Mm-hmm. I found it interesting that back in 1974, $1 million was still $1 million. It was still serious money. When they did the remake in 2009, they upped it to $10 million.
That's right.
Inflation. There you go. Today, it probably would be $100 million.
Well, I'm assuming you've seen Austin Powers. He says he wants $1 million and everyone looks at him like he's crazy. And then he raises the number. He keeps raising it because of inflation.
I mean, the numbers, when one movie, Mission Impossible, costs $400 million, you can't have hijackers asking for $1 million. It's just doesn't make much sense.
Well, they should be hijacking a plane filled with movie producers in order to get that money.
Movie producers or sports figures. I live in Los Angeles. We've paid Shohei Ohtani $700 million. Actually, although he's deferred his salary for now. But just the concept that one human being who hits a baseball really well and pitches from time to time gets $700 million is so incongruous for me. It's just it's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. And I'm sure if we looked at the budget for the original Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, it was probably very modest.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I don't think I was able to find that information. I think we talked about that the very beginning, in the first episode. I don't think that I was able to find a place that said what the actual budget was.
I'm thinking it was probably between 4 and 5 million, maybe. I may be a little high.
Right. I would say that it's even that's at the most.
Yeah.
The estimate of how much it made in the box office was $5 million. That was the estimate.
According to IMDb, the film did really well in cities which had subways.
Surprisingly.
surprise, it didn't play well in cities that their rapid transit system was lacking.
Right. Do you think this is considered a cult classic at this point?
Oh,
or
sure. Anybody who sees this movie today has got to come away impressed. I mean, first of all, your casting is just perfect. Of course, anytime Walter Matthau came on screen, whatever he was doing, he was like a national treasure. And combining that with Robert Shaw, Hector Elizondo, what Martin Balsam. And then we haven't talked much about the character actors that make up this cast. I mean, every time you cut away to a character actor, you get the who's who.
Right, well, we haven't seen them yet. Dick O'Neill, Lee Wallace,
Tony
Jerry
Roberts,
Stiller.
who we just lost. I mean, I was just I know we I haven't we haven't gotten to them yet, but I think that I was pulling what's interesting about the character actors in this movie is they're very New York. It's
Yes.
not like they came to LA and got a bunch of actors to be in the film, have LA actors playing New York actors. They got the cream of New York character actors. I'm just looking down the line. Lee Wallace, of course, played the mayor. One of my favorite people, and we'll see him in a later episode, but I'll just mention him in brief. Tom Petty, which is spelled PEDI, by the way. This is not the musician. Played Kaz
Kaz
Dalowitz, or as Dick O'Neill calls him, Fat Kaz.
That's right. Which you can
He's
get
the
away,
guy.
which they could have gotten away with back then. Nowadays, they wouldn't be able to get away
Oh, I
with calling a
know, but
character that.
Kaz, what a New York performer is Kaz as Tom Petty. Just wonderful. But
Have
anyway,
you seen Tom Petty in other things?
I haven't.
Right,
I haven't.
exactly. He stands out for me in this movie.
Oh yeah. He's
And
big.
according to IMDb, he was in 49 different movies,
Oh, there you go. There
including
you go.
he was in The Naked City in 1948.
Not surprising, another very New York-y movie.
Yeah, I'm looking at the stuff that he was in. There isn't anything that really jumps out.
That's another thing that's
He was in a
great.
movie. He was in a movie called in 1976 called Saint Ives, where his character's name was Fat Angie. So Fat Kaz, Fat Angie.
And when I can't get into discussing his character because that's not our show. But anyway, the guys who are doing the minutes where Fat Kaz is present will have fun with him.
Oh, for sure, for sure. Especially if you look at the script with what he originally said, there are things that he says that they trimmed out for the movie because they just, I guess, went too far.
There you go. There
Yeah.
you go.
All right. So we have Mr. Blue basically threatening the driver, and he says, "Shut up." He goes, "I won't tell you again." And he cocks his gun and he goes, "Open the door or I'll blow your head off." Because at this point we see that Mr. Green is getting ready to come in, and he opens the door, and we see Mr. Green come into the cab also. And then the shot changes, and we get to see Mr. Gray just hanging out, literally, by holding onto one of the handrails, the ceiling rails and stuff like that. Just trying to just make sure that nobody's going to go into that front car. And he stands there guarding the door, and a man shows up and goes, "May I get by, please?" And he goes, "No, you don't want to go in there." "Well, suppose I do anyway." And then this guy is close to him, and then Mr. Gray goes, "Then I'll shoot your peepee off." And then the camera pans down, and we see that he's holding a gun to the guy's crotch.
Not only a gun, a submachine gun.
Well, you can't tell. It looks like he's holding something in his pocket. So I don't think he hasn't pulled out the submachine gun at this point.
Okay.
And then he goes, "Now just go back out the window and no, sorry." And then the guy just turns around. And then we're back with
Mr. Blue?
No. We're back with Mr. Brown, who's talking with Bud, and he goes, "Now, just go back out the window and tell me what you see." And he peeks his head out the window and goes, "Someone's leaning against the head car." He goes, "Great. The second he comes aboard, you shut the doors." And, you know, Bud, we can see Bud is scared. There's no question about that. But also, I love the shot because they show us that he's maybe three or four cars back. And you can look ahead and you see that Mr. Blue is just standing there at the edge of the train. And you see, like, I never thought about the fact that there was always somebody on a train that looks to make sure that everything's clear before they close the doors. I thought it was something just automatic, you know, that the doors open for 15 seconds or whatever it is, you know, and whoever gets through, whoever doesn't, and that's it. I didn't realize that there's someone who's actually pushing the button, opening and closing throughout the entire train.
Well, that was back in the 70s. Do you think they still do that?
I have no idea. It's been a few years. I've been on a New York subway.
Yeah, I bet it's all automated now because, first of all, those trains are long. I've been in subway stations where they stretch out of sight, or not out of sight, but it's almost like you can't see the whole train. Just look. Maybe you can. I guess maybe. I almost want to feel like that some of the cars are not there, but they all should be at the ramp. So, but I would think that today with AI and all of the technology available, that it no longer involves a guy looking out the window to see if anybody's standing near a door.
Right. True. I remember one of my brothers once said, this was years ago, that he actually got a ticket because he tried holding the door open for somebody. And, you know, that's a no-no. So you got fined for doing that in the New York subway. So, but... You know, Bud is following orders, and then we see the shot from Bud's viewpoint, which is also great, that we see someone get onto the train, and then we see Mr. Blue basically leave his stuff and, you know, pick up his stuff and then move into the train himself, which works really well by showing us, you know, from this perspective. And then Bud closes the doors. We see that someone barely gets in. And then the shot changes, and we're in the cab itself at the very front of the train. Once again, we can still see the two boys jumping on the window next to them, which it's so beautifully shot because, you know, the screen is split in two. You have on one side these two rambunctious kids jumping up and down on the train. And then on the other side, you see, you know, Danny Doyle and Mr. Green in this already cramped space, which is about to get even more cramped for them.
Right, exactly.
But it really does look like a split screen the way that they have it set up, which is very nice. And then we see Mr. Blue open the door and start to come in. And he says, "Keep your hand off the microphone, buddy." You know, making sure that the conductor is not going to flip the switch, saying that you know, we're SOS, we're in you know, hijacking situation. Like, it's interesting. You think about it, and you know, for decades, we've always thought about, when you think of the word hijack, you think of a plane, and on planes, there, you know, from what I know from movies, there are procedures of what you do if your plane gets hijacked. You know, and that makes sense. It makes me wonder if they have protocols on a train before this movie came out, thinking about what happens if you get hijacked. You know, do they have a button that says, you know, hijack? That type of thing.
Yeah, that's a very good question. I don't know the answer to that, but certainly in 1974, as Walter Matthau will explain later on, that you can't drive the train without somebody constantly putting pressure on that control switch. So if the driver disappears, then the train grounds to a halt. So they can't have a runaway train situation.
Right, but that has nothing to do with if there's a hijacking. That just
No, it's
means
true.
that somebody has to be there to constantly have his hand, his finger on the button, or pressure, applying pressure on the, on the stick type of thing.
No, that's very true. That's very true. The concept of hijacking a subway train was so unknown at that time that I don't think anybody had any plans on what to do in situations like that. So, I mean, if you think about it, as we've talked about it, it's a bit ridiculous to think that anybody would want to. It's not like a gold train that's transporting bullion from Fort Knox.
That's right. It's got more, more precious cargo. It's got voters.
It's got voters, 17 of them.
I love how every single one of them is described in the credits, and also on IMDb, by their by, I guess, by their profession, or by who they're, that you have the maid, the mother, the homosexual, the secretary, the delivery boy, the salesman, the hooker, the old man, the older son, the Spanish woman, the alcoholic, the pimp. And then you have the hippie, the wasp. So it's very clever that they don't give any of these characters real names, because we don't need to know who they are. They are an eclectic view of society, and that's what Mr. Blue wants here. He
Right.
wants to apply enough pressure that the city is going to have to pay the ransom,
Right, exactly.
and they do it really well from that perspective. Once again, we're at the end of a minute. Did you have anything else you wanted to talk about with this minute, besides the suspense, continuing to build?
I don't have anything else to add. Just as you point out, we have a very eclectic group of people on the train. I always liked Michael Gorin, who played the old man. I thought that he's kind of a sage. He's been riding subways for 50 years. So it's good to have somebody who knows something about the subway system, although he learns that he doesn't know everything. And I really liked, who else did I like? Well, there are so many people on
No,
there. There's
I'm
17
shocked.
people.
He's only 60 in this movie. When he
He's
made this
crazy.
movie, he was 60. He looks a
Right.
hell of a lot older than that.
No, he looked like, I think they did a lot of makeup help there, absolutely. But I'm ready to move on.
And he only has 32 IMDb credits over his career, but there's nothing that really jumps out, except for he was in Justice for All as the elderly man.
Okay.
But
Sounds like you've made a career of playing
I
elderly
guess
men.
that's right. He got typecast after making this movie. You're only 60, but we're gonna figure out a way of making you look older in all these movies. You're the old Jewish guy who's gonna say, I've been riding this train for as long as since I was a kid. All right, so every Thursday we have a segment which is a game. It's called 70s Trivia Potpourri. And basically, once again, it will be randomly selected, so I don't know what it is. I've chosen I've created over 100 trivia questions about movies that came out in the 70s, and I will we'll see what trivia questions you get. You get five of these. Okay.
Okay, I'm
And
ready.
again, because they're random, you could get multiple questions of the same movie. It anything is possible. So we will spin the wheel and let's see what we get. Okay, the first one is what 1970s film is known for using Scott Joplin's music, The Entertainer, as the musical score?
The Sting.
Yes.
Scott Joplin. Joplin.
What did I call him?
You said Scott Joplin.
Oh, Joplin. Excuse me. Joplin, tomato, tomato.
Let's get the whole thing off. Let's t take the whole, whatever they say. Okay, go
All
ahead.
right. Let us spin the wheel once again and see what we get. Okay. Who wrote the lyrics to the theme song of Suicide is Painless from the 1970 movie MASH?
Ooh, that is a good question. I think you got me there.
Okay, it is Robert Altman's 14-year-old son, Mike Altman.
Oh, okay.
Okay, the 14-year-old son of director Robert Altman, Mike Altman, wrote the lyrics to the theme song Suicide is Painless, and because of its inclusion in the subsequent TV series, he continued to get residuals throughout its run and throughout its syndication. His father was paid $75,000 for directing the movie, but he eventually made over $2 million in song royalties. And the payments are still, you know, are still being paid.
Unbelievable.
Yes. Seriously, that's just amazing. All right. We'll now go for the next question. We shall spin the wheel once again. Okay. Okay, what 1970s movie is about a group of escaped Nazis and their followers who are trying a second try at world domination?
Okay, I would say The Boys from Brazil.
That is correct. 1978, The Boys from Brazil. Very good. All right, let us spin the wheel for your fourth question. Okay, there is a movie from 1970 called Little Big Man, featuring Dustin Hoffman, who plays the last survivor of what famous battle?
Battle of the Little Bighorn.
That is correct. Very good. All right, so now we will go for your final trivia question. Spinning the wheel, let's see what we get. Okay, what 1970 movie, from 1970, not the decade, was the first film to portray a touch-tone telephone when most people were still using rotary dials?
Wow. That's a pretty esoteric question. A touch-tone telephone for a 1970 movie. I know of two movies from that year. I'll take a pot shot and say Love Story.
Okay, that is not correct. And what was the other one you were going to guess?
Well, it's certainly not Patton, because Patton takes place in the 1940s.
No.
So what is the name of this movie?
Can you think of any other movie from 1970? This was a movie that was nominated for Best Picture that year. I don't know if that helps you.
Oh, would it be Airport?
It would. It is Airport, yes.
Oh, okay. There you go.
Yes. So, yes, it is Airport. It's an interesting bit of trivia. You know, so. I mean, like I told you before, it's understandable that most people wouldn't be able to guess that. So, yeah. Don't feel bad that you didn't know that one. All right, so now we will do the daily game of Name That Remake. So we will now spin the wheel for that also and see what remake Steve needs to guess today. And the wheel is spinning. Okay, the original movie was from 1953, and the remake was made in 1977 about a group of four men that need to transport something across the country.
Is it Sorcerer?
Sorcerer is the remake, yes.
It's the remake. The original was called The Wages of Fear.
That is correct. Very good. Excellent. Nicely done, Steve. Nicely done.
Thank you.
Okay, so Once again, why don't you tell people where they can find you?
Yes, I have two podcasts, Stephen J. Rubin's Saturday Night at the Movies on all your podcast platforms. That's J-A-Y spelled out. And I have a podcast. It also is on YouTube. I also co-host a podcast called Tales from Hollywoodland with Julian Schlossberg and Arthur E. Friedman, two fellow producers. I have a Facebook page, Stephen J. Rubin. I have a page on Facebook called the James Bond Movie Encyclopedia. And I'm on LinkedIn, X, and Instagram. You can Google Stephen J. Rubin, and I'm sure you can find me.
All right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. And if you feel like sending me an email, you can send it to movierobminute@movierob.net. So, until tomorrow,
Gesundheit.